Fred Astron is professor and chair of the Department of Jewish Studies at San Francisco State University. He received his PhD in Near Eastern Studies from the University of California at Berkeley in 1993, same good year for graduates.
You can edit that thing.
He holds a BES, I've never heard of that one, degree from the University of Minnesota with specialization in medieval history and an MA in Arabic from UC Berkeley. Areas of research include medieval Jewish history in the Mediterranean and in the orbit of early Islam, Jewish-Muslim relations, and the Karaite Jewish sect. His current book project is entitled Before the Geniza, on Jews in the Mediterranean in the Early Middle Ages.
Thank you. I won't turn to the question of terminology because it's an interesting and yet endless exercise, except to put emphasis on one observation that Emily made, and that is religion, the study of religion has kind of fallen out from a lot of this, and certainly wasn't present very much at all in our conversation today. Working on the early Middle Ages allows me to think about these things perhaps in a different way, sometimes by bringing a very long view to the subject matter, and sometimes by bringing what I think are cognates to the situation. And so I want to begin in the year 478, which is the year that's usually associated with the fall of the Roman Empire in the West. And this isn't a joke, actually. So the subsequent era has been characterized as one where what had been the Roman Empire in the West was conquered by the so-called barbarian or Germanic peoples, and they established kingdoms. And it took us from Peter Brown and a generation to begin to rethink how we thought of that moment after Rome, you can put that in quotes, as a time of a lot of continuity with Rome, and that there wasn't a kind of a instant transformation of what had been the Roman Empire into Germanic kingdoms. And so taking that cognate, I want to suggest, and it doesn't apply as much to North Africa as it does to the East, I want to suggest thinking about a post-Ottoman context, perspective on thinking about history, which is to say the matter of the Ottoman Empire, the assumptions of collectivity that people had in different settings and different situations, the hangover, the leftovers, even the detritus of its legal regime, etc., populates the history since the fall of the empire. In Middle East studies, we look at the 20th century and we look at the current bit of this century, and we're talking about post-colonial studies and post-imperial history, and there's this constant reference to the rewriting of the boundaries in the Sykes-Picot Agreement and in other matters, and the Ottomans are kind of forgotten. And in fact, notions of identity formation, the place of religion in society, etc., remain part of a conversation today, whether we range from ISIS to the State of Israel, and we can go on and on and on. So the fact of the matter is, if we are studying the Sephardim, whose history goes through a corridor or is threaded through and with Ottoman history, then we must conceive of a post-Ottoman moment that we're living in right now, and that as historians we need to kind of add this extra context to things. It's not all about Europe, which is something that everyone's been saying here in different ways, but maybe not with the longer view in mind. And so we can think about things really quite differently, I think, when we add this way of going at it. What's at stake? I think many of our speakers today answered that question in terms of what is the field, what's at stake in the study of history, maybe not so much in terms of nationalisms and other identities of the modern period. But let me go forward just by taking some observations and bringing some questions to each of the papers, and then allow that to be a way for us to continue the conversation. And I'll leave Emily out because she's not here, and so it's not fair. And I got to speak to her paper a little bit already. So Susan's paper on the state of research on the Shoah in North Africa, well, all of them are really, really interesting, and it makes me really glad to be here. Brings up an interesting question, and that is, and there was a comment, the woman's no longer here, there was a comment that made me think about Zionist history and the kind of meta-narrative of Zionist history that actually includes a project of some rewriting of Jewish history in North Africa in the late 19th and 20th century. And you modernists need to correct me if I'm mistaken in this, but that Zionism was not a big hit among Jews in North Africa, but that so much writing, historical writing coming out of Israel wanted to find a way to show that those Jews really understood what Zionism is and that they were actually proto-Zionists, or they were in some way Zionists themselves. And so what's striking is that there's an unlinking between what I know about that and what you just taught us about the Shoah. Because one would think that if there is a kind of a rehabilitation of a rewriting of a Zionist presence among Jews of North Africa, that they would then want to incorporate the Shoah as an element of that narrative of persecution and redemption, which is not only a Zionist narrative, but it's kind of a meta-narrative that goes back to the Wissenschaft. And so it's actually surprising that it doesn't take that route, and it goes another way. And so your thoughts on that as we go forward will be very, very interesting to me. And then everything, all the questions you ask have a kind of an added nuance to them in that regard. And so that's one way of getting at what Emily referred to as the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and that is, and Aron referred to the turbulence, that's a good word, that the Arab-Israeli conflict brings into Sephardic studies. From Aron's paper, especially the observations at the end about the field and of Jewish studies and the subfield, has to have an added question to it. What do all the things that you brought to that, the observations and questions you bring to that, have to do in a Jewish studies field that may actually have peaked, may be declining? In a Jewish studies field where the community in those in creating endowed chairs from the community are now interested in other matters as their communal concerns shift away from the academy and move towards other things. And if Jewish studies is going to shrink in the future, I really should have asked all the grad students to leave the room when I talk about this, but I think it's an important matter. Then what is a marginalized, a small or a niche component of Jewish studies, a subfield of Jewish studies, or a sub-subfield might be the best way to put it, then what is the future for that in a shrinking Jewish studies? And Sarah, one thing that struck me is that when we're talking about extraterritoriality and the protections that could be provided by having papers, passports, etc., we're talking about personality of law, something that in the long term of Jewish history is a very familiar matter, that the law that you're subject to accompanies you, and there isn't a territoriality of the law. And yet this situation you describe is a kind of an in-between, between the classic personality of law, which is associated with Jews defined either as a people and a religion, and the modern nation state. And Jews have experience with this. So this is a kind of a last moment of personality of the law. And you can't say in the age of the nation, because the age of the nation had started some time ago. But when the age of the nation is finally becoming articulated in the post-Ottoman moment, and this moment of confusion then tells you not only about the fantastic subjects that you brought to us, but really all of the identities in the Balkans and others that are going to emerge in the wake of the Ottoman Empire. Anecdotally, I'll tell you that David Sorkin and I were at Oxford at the same time on sabbatical, and I tried to argue with him to include Sephardic Jews in his notion of port Jews. But he was so married to the idea of emancipation and as a Western emancipation that he didn't want to go there. And maybe he felt he wasn't trained or willing to think about this, but Sarah's paper tells me my sense of that was right, and that in fact, especially the Austro-Hungarians, they want a railroad to Salonika, they want another Trieste. They want, and they don't see these Jews so different from their quasi-emancipated Jews that are living in Trieste at that time. And in the long, long, long run, in this paper, the Jews as having utility, that the Portuguese, the Spanish, and the Austro-Hungarians thinking that Jews have utility is a really quite an old story. When in 1084, when the Bishop of Speyer says, to make my village a town, I need some Jews. And so there's some myth as well as some reality to that moment in 1912, 1913. There's a long narrative that underlies the practicality of who these Jews are in the economy and what they could mean in some future reconfiguration of the Aegean and of Greece, etc., etc. And so the question I like asking, I think, applies to Sarah's material when it comes to these categories of nation and citizen, et cetera, is not only noticing the spectrum of citizenship and categories of citizenship and semi-citizenship, but really the kind of situational question of asking, when do they resonate? What situation is sufficient for them to have meaning instead of them being kind of completely static and very high-level ideas that lay over the entire situation? And so, too many notes, and too much good material in the presentations that we've seen. So I want to bring it back to religion just at the end, because it, as already was observed with the chief rabbi of the Sfaradim and of the Ashkenazim in Israel, it has so much to do with halakha, religious practice, ritual, religious life, and yet it really didn't play in so much in our conversation today, yet it remains in the background. Yes, Emily is right, it is the more problematic of the ways to talk about Sephardic Jews, but I don't think we should ignore it, because by taking it out, we are diminishing the subject. And so much more to say, but really let me open it up to everybody else now while we still have some time.
Would you like to respond to your comments?
Sure,
that
yeah.
That would be great, yeah.
Yes.
You volunteered.
This question about Zionism in North Africa is a complicated one. It has its own trajectory and its own subtlety as a phenomenon. But the association with the Shoah. Let me just make some generalizations here that I feel have a validity. One is that the war made North African Jews visible. the Second World War, they were an unknown, mysterious quantity, vaguely thought of as being exotic flowering of Jewish life on a periphery that was sort of in the same bag with the Jews of Yemen or the Jews of, I don't know where else, you know, Kazakhstan, or that they were some kind of mysterious, inconsequential, and not very important central aspect or entity in global Jewish life, but interesting. When American Jews among the American troops arrived in Morocco in 1942, they were amazed to find synagogues, beautiful Jewish women who a number of them married, Jews living among Muslims and surviving, Jews living in cities, Jews living in the countryside. The fluorescence of saying Jewish life in Morocco was an eye-opener for them. And I'd say the same was true in Tunisia and Algeria. At the same time, these Jews never had really intimate contact with any Jews, the occasion of maybe French Jews, but certainly not American Jews, who were a totally different thing. And we have very interesting information on this encounter between American Jews and Moroccan Jews. Moreover, American helping organizations like the Joint suddenly discovered this vast repository of Jews that they hadn't known about, this material, Homer Ishi, that they could make use of. And as the goals of American helping organizations matured after the Second World War and moved from helping refugees to rescuing, and not only rescuing, but recruiting Jews for the Zionist project, these Jews in North Africa became a really important element. And gathering them up, counting them, enumerating what their skills were, was a primary project of organizations like the Joint that took on a new life after the war. Not particularly Zionist before the war, but after the war, very much engaged in the project of building the new state of Israel. And the North African Jews had utility. They were a repository of Jewish life and Jewish civilization that was seen as an asset for the state. And that's when these Jews became interesting and enmeshed in the Zionist project. And as this project developed, the concomitant reaction was the deterioration of Jewish life in North Africa. To see them as a balance that moved in this direction, as the pull toward integration developed and grew, for whatever reason, whether it was to get away from the French, or to realize a new life in Zion, or to take advantage of opportunities that were promised to them, life, Jewish communal life in Morocco, disintegrated. Of course, there are other political factors as well, the rise of nationalism and loss of faith in the French promise of equality. But we have to contextualize this question of Zionism within larger issues of what was happening globally in the Middle East and also in the regions. It's your talk, but please.
But I just
know more about this.
Well, I don't know, but the idea, what you said, that the persecution and redemption, surprisingly, that it didn't take root. I would argue that it did, but not in terms of the Shoah or Germany. Instead, the Zionist narrative made that with the Muslims and Arabs, and that's where the persecution took place, and the redemption and going to Israel, whereas they were excluded, because of that guarding the Shoah for the Ashkenazi. But it was very much at play, but with a different narrative.
Can I ask an outsider's question on this point? Because this whole question of Sephardic identity, which has been so skillfully broken down into small pieces by the historians, and that's what the historians do. The Israeli context is the one place where Sephardic identity clearly is something. So it, it's a clear and definite thing it, for all sorts of ideological and other reasons. So what I'm wondering is if you go back before a Sephardic identity belongs to the narrative of Arab persecution and sort of the part of the legitimizing of Israel's state. What is it that links Sephardic Jews in a small Moroccan village or in North Africa with the Jews of the Ottoman Empire? When I'm thinking of Europe, I can think, well, you know, there's a strong rabbinical network, there are lots of economic relationships and things like that. So I have a clear concept of what Ashkenazi is. But what's Sephardic before the Israeli use of the Sephardic?
Well, this underlies the problem of Ashkenazi as well, because if we're talking about in shorthand all the time, so when we say European Jewry, why is a shtetl Jew more European than a Jew in Alexandria at a particular moment? What makes that category? I mean, who are we talking about? This is all broken down by class, by where they're plugged in. I mean, I've always been kind of surprised by all the way in which, amused really, more than surprised by the way in which large parts of the Ashkenazi world, which are not really deeply engaged until very late with something called what we now retroactively associate as Europe, which is very much based with Enlightenment and other kind of post-Enlightenment developments. I mean, we can make the same argument really within the Ashkenazi world, and that is really the question. So what does a shtetl Jew in 1890 have in common with a Parisian Jew? And why is that a similar Ashkenazi network? That makes as much sense,
or as little sense,
as the Sephardic.
I heard Chris asking more about, is there a consciousness of this connection?
But the problem is,
and who has it?
Right. But what I'm really saying is that
if you push it back in Europe, there are stronger connections between those communities in the 15th century or the 17th century than there are after the rise of the nation state.
Exactly. And I think that's yeah. I mean, I wasn't really not
yeah,
that serious,
no,
but I was really trying to say that we can problematize that for other Jewish communities to the same degree.
But one part of the problem is that we have inherited categories that come from tradition. They have
liturgy.
Not liturgy as much as biological notions of descent that, of course, we know are always problematic, and notions from religion. And then we use these categories in the academy, and...
But aren't we also overestimating the category of religion, because we're assuming there's one liturgical and rabbinical tradition that spans the Atlas Mountains to Iran, and that is simply not true, actually, because I think that's a kind of a non-Ashkenazi imposition of the same kind of grid, as you know. I mean, as you know very well, I mean, the rabbinical mode of communication and the responsa and the way certain things were evolved over time was very regional. That is to say, it would be almost impossible for somebody from Marrakesh to send to Salonika for a rabbinical ruling. It could have happened, but it was just as easy to have happened in different kind of ways. I actually do not necessarily believe there's an all-encompassing, unifying halachic world itself, because it really goes to the next greatest sage next door, and it goes as far as that. And I think this whole thing is very much a modern.
Couldn't you say there's a memory of, or a fantasy of such relationships embedded in Jewish law?
That's what I would ask.
Well, what is the memory?
In the 19th century, there was a re-identification with a larger Sephardic world.
Well, what's that?
Mainly through people like, what's his name, Gretz and the Wissenschaft movement. But this was imposed from outside. I mean, I've heard educated Moroccan Jews deny that the worship of saints was part of Moroccan Jewish practice, when everyone knows that the vast majority of Moroccan Jews are saint worshippers. But the elites have a certain concept of the Jewish world is quite different from, it's a matter of social class, it's a matter of education.
Actually, in that respect, just to add on, I mean, a lot of work is now being done that, in fact, the entire category of Sephardi, imagined and constructed by the Ashkenazi world, was then imported in what we're now calling Sephardi world and created other imaginary boundaries and links, which, in fact, historically did not exist.
Right.
And
I
so,
mean,
you know, we
assume Nolia Aliyos. Every single Aliyos library had a copy of Gratz's History of the Jews in French. But any student who went through the Aliyos education knew about that book.
Right.
And it was and bought into it.
Well, this is the beauty of 19th century education is that it homogenized this whole
kinds
of things. Every European.
Fred, I think that Susan wants
to. Yes. Susan has a question.
Well, I was just going to say that I think that if you want to go back to what we think of as the paradigm of Sephardic life, that would be on the Iberian Peninsula, you would have, except for a poetic construction of Sephard, you would never have heard a medieval, a pre-expulsion Iberian refer to themselves as a Sephardic Jew. They referred to themselves by locale. They were... And they probably wouldn't even, on the larger scale, say, I'm Aragonese, I'm Catalonian, I'm Valencian, I am Castilian. They would say, I'm from Teruel. I am from, you know, whatever other small conglomeration of towns. Which means that...
Which is what anybody living in Europe at the time...
Exactly. But it also means that what we have built, this kind of imaginary construct of the paradigm of Sephardic identity on, never actually existed. And as you know, I briefly referenced in my paper this morning, once you have people post-expulsion leaving the Iberian Peninsula in these various waves, you end up again having them identify themselves by their place of origin. Mm-hmm. They don't say, I'm Sephardic. So it's this retrojection back to a much later construct, and when we build on that with this idea of this overarching Sephardic identity, as all of the papers today have noted, what does that mean for a Jew in Morocco, a Jew that lived in the Ottoman Empire, a Jew who lived in Iran, a Jew who lived in Italy? You know, it becomes really a very difficult concept to support.
I'm sorry, because I find myself sort of sounding like I'm advocating a position that I don't really need to advocate. But of course, the same would be true for any, you know, the identity German or the identity Polish or French or whatever.
What?
So you know what makes those names effective names, useful names, you know, the names that will never abandon, is the nation state. That has sort of redefined that idea. Like somehow we get back to Israel, and you know, being Sephardic or Ashkenazi as an element of a kind of national identity, is it necessary or possible to completely be disabused of that? It's not unusual for an identity of such a kind to be associated with an So now I sound like I'm, you know, just advocating for a strong Zionist position. I don't really mean by doing that, but it does seem to me, if it's good for a German, why shouldn't it be good for a German?
It's a little different, for one thing. I mean, it's not about saying anymore. And the other thing is, why are we having this conversation about that level of identity? I mean, you can also have the conversation about the word Jew. I mean, is it really different to be talking about Jews and to be talking about Sephardim? And then,
well, it's a lot easier.
And then, isn't the question how we mobilize these terms and why and when and what kind of ideological work they are? And what Sarah was saying is, when does it do a certain kind of work for the person to use them? And what kinds of, let's say, what kinds of conversations are enabled by this configuration? And then what kinds of conversations are ruled out, and the idea that somehow there's something ironic, I guess, about the fact that we're ruling out a certain kind of let's say, critique of Jewish identity, critique of Zionist identity by affirming that there is this thing called Sephardic identity and those people are marginalized and secondary. So as if the dominant term needs its secondary foil for its own strength and power, and that the word Sephardic no longer does whatever kind of, let's say, problematizing, it no longer has that power. I think you were saying that it does. I mean, in some way, the question of does the Shoah look different if we talk about what it looks like in North Africa, or is it just that we've bolstered the power of Shoah discourse by adding this other element? So maybe, I can't believe I'm talking. I'm so far outside this.
Not as far as I am. Let me offer opportunities to our owner, Sarah, to respond also.
Material things like jobs and other elements,
but that's what it's about.
It is. It actually is
or
all refractive.
Citizenship or papers.
Exactly.
Or
all of this.
Okay.
So, actually, the one biggest threat to Jewish studies is not the lack of material elements, it's the creation of Israel studies positions. That is to say that in many, many ways that has can, in fact, cannibalize, to a very large extent, positions. And it's a very problematic and non-existent really field in many ways. I don't need to go into this, but I think you raise a very important point. I mean, but at the same time, I think I'm slightly more sanguine than you mentioned, because there are actually many, many positions that have been done. There is generational change. There are going to, this is certainly much healthier situation than many other fields in academia. And so I do see threats and problems in terms of the thing, but I do also see the threats. I don't think I gave an overly optimistic presentation itself. In fact, it was distinctly pessimistic, but it was really more pessimistic in terms of what we are calling this inchoate kind of thing, finding its place both ideologically and, I mean, not ideologically, but theoretically, analytically, in terms of shaking things up and really kind of integrating itself in its most natural multiple habitats. And again, this is hugely problematic given all that we've been talking about, because this is like, when we look at it, we can problematize this to non-existence, and yet, in some sort of way, we know what we're talking about. And so, and I really do think that when all is said and done, and now I'll be very provocative, I think that most of Sephardic existence is dead. I actually believe that word, I mean, the diasporic studies can do it for one or two generations after they left homelands, it becomes something else now. So even when we talk about Israel Sephardic, we're talking about something else. And therefore, even though I am uncomfortable with it, remove two or three decades from a predominantly Islamic or Islamicate world, there is no continuity to Sephardic in terms of what really, its main interlocutor, which got problematized with the introduction of colonialism and all kind of other things, but its main kind of place where it was face to face for over a millennium, I mean, more than that, you know, since Muhammad. Once that goes, we're talking about ultimately entirely new realities, you know, and what has emerged in Israel, for example, as Mizrahim, is a distinctly Israeli ethnic product that has very little to do with the old world. It's a completely new kind of category. And as they have moved after generations, one or two generations, you know, when we talk about Latin America, it doesn't mean they're like everybody else, but I think there is a whole, there is no such thing as everybody else. But I actually do think we do need to think of, you know, why this sort of deep engagement in predominantly Muslim societies eventually means that once they're not in predominantly Muslim societies, emerge into a different kind of place. Now, we don't have test cases, because of the really problematic one, which is, if Bulgarian Jewry had remained in place, if Yugoslav or Greek Jewry had not been destroyed, if, you know, all of these, and we would have been able to really study people staying where they were.
We do
and
test cases.
Which was,
we have used it in
Ukraine. No, but I'm talking really about the non-remnant communities. They're very small minorities. We cannot say that these are communities destined to have a very great longevity. If there is a community under 10,000 people,
they do believe. They do.
But they may believe, I'm not denying that, but I think as historians, communities under 10,000, cut off from other communities or whatever, are not necessarily ones that are destined to have a very long life. In terms of, I mean, you know, by a lot of accounts, you know this much better than me, Moroccan Jewry is under 5,000. Now, to what extent their discourse now may say we have a great future here, but I think there's demographics.
I thought you were asking a different question. I thought you were asking a question of how these communities become represented in the sense of how their history is being made use of.
No, I am asking that question, but what I'm really also saying is that in this first half of the 21st century, first decades of the 21st century, what we are really talking about is, except for a few remnants, a completely new development, a new entity, a post-Sephardic world.
I agree with you, but I don't know if it's so post, because I see the way these histories are being appropriated by the nation state. I mean, in Morocco, they're not absent. They make use of the community to build an image of multi-ethnicity and multiplicity in the new Middle Eastern state, which is a state that is aspires to be a model of democracy and rule of law.
But I mean, it's much easier to do that when there are virtually no Jews than when there are hundreds of thousands of Jews. I mean, that's the reality.
That's right.
For sure, the Jews who are there have to be complicit in this appropriation.
That's exactly
what's happening.
And this echoes what Susan said, the change in 1492 even. So thank you for getting out of the meta-narrative of the remnant shall survive and redemption, etc., by making that provocative claim.
It's odd to say that the subject, I mean, as a historian, it doesn't bother me as much as anybody else, but I think basically Sephardic history is over.
Sarah, do you want to have the last word before we wrap up?
Well, I don't know if I had the last word, but I think, you know, what Susan was just talking about, I think, brings us back to a motif that you raised in response to my paper, which is this theme of Jewish utility. Because what, you know, Susan is talking about this interesting contemporary moment where the state perceives that there is something, some measure of social capital to be accrued by appropriating a story about Jewish culture in Morocco. And the Jewish communities are complicit. And I think that the presentation I offered is also thinking of Jewish utility not only from the perspective of the state, but from the bottom up. And to say there are ways in which Jews can assess and cannily utilize their own utility. Because they understand that there are state figures who want something out of them, that they're not passive in this process, that it's a dynamic. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, in my own work in the field of Sephardic studies, it's been my interest to move away from abstraction towards histories of individuals. So to kind of relocalize this history. And I see that in a lot of the work of those who presented here, and in a lot of the work of a new generation of scholars. And language training is crucial to this. And I think we could actually map transformation of Jewish studies and Sephardic studies simply through the question of language study, mm-hmm. and what doors and what archives and what documents are opened because of the different choices that are made in training. So I think that that's if Sephardic studies failed to enter Jewish history through the Wissenschaft because it only entered through trope and fantasy, now maybe it can seize its place, you know, through an attention to specificity.
Fred?
That's a good final word.
Can we say that's a good ending? Thank you so much, all of you.